So Michael first trained as an actor, training at Bretton Hall, and then turned to directing, graduating from Mount View postgraduate theatre directing course. And he was first at the RSC as part of the long ensemble that was here from 2009 to 2011, predominantly working with Michael Boyd on As You Like It and Rupert Gould, Romeo and Juliet. You then directed members of the company
and in Ahasuerus,
which is a new play which was in Hampstead. So this is actually your directorial debut at the RSC.
In Stratford,
yes.
I've done my RSC London, yeah.
Post the RSC, Michael's biggest thing has been co-directing The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe with Rupert Gould again in a tent in Kensington Gardens last summer.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit, because it's thinking about you were here as an assistant director, moved to associate and then directing a new play in a small theatre. Can you tell us quickly before we get into the tightest moment, something about that quick journey from an AD through to this production and how that's happened?
Well, I hadn't assisted before I came here. No, I did the Weir. At the Basingstoke Haymarket when I was 21. But that was the last time I'd assisted, and So I was 26, and I had 9 interviews for the long ensemble. I had to meet Greg, I met Rupert, I met Lucy Bailey, I met David, I met the producers, I met lots and lots of people. And by the time I got through those 9 interviews, I was thinking that maybe I don't really want to do this because this is all a bit effortful. And my last interview was with Michael Boyd, and he said, how do you feel about coming here for 3 years? And I said, oh, do you know what, Michael, actually, I feel a bit worried that... you might just want tea boys. And that made me really, really worried. Someone to make tea for you and watch. And he said, no, absolutely what we want is directors. Well, no, absolutely what I want is directors, so that I know that I can trust my work with someone that not only can maintain it, but that can carry on developing it and making it more and more and more and more alive. And so I sort of came here with an arrogance that I sort of thought I'd probably take the place over in about 3 years because this was a place where you could come and do it. And although that wasn't entirely the truth, it wasn't too far from the truth in the sense that by the end of my first year here, I was already leaving to go away and direct tours of my own. I was being given the time to go off and do that and being treated respectfully in that manner. And in conversations with the company about, ironically, directing... I wanted to do Titus Andronicus in a warehouse in Stratford with 20 professional actors and 200 community people. And they said, no, that's ridiculous, you can't do that, that's too expensive. But we kept talking over a couple of years, and then I directed... Michael quite kindly gave all of the assistant directors, there was 4 of us, Justin Alderbear, Vic Sivalingam and Helena Blake, who are all doing very, very well now. He gave 4 of us 2 nights at the Hampstead Theatre. He gave us full technical support, he gave us a pick of the ensemble that we were... working with, and he gave us a choice of actors from outside of the profession. So I did a new Vasily Sergeyev play called Ahasuerus. I had Jonjo O'Neill from the Long Ensemble, Forbes Masson from the Long Ensemble. I had Davan Dweevor from the Long Ensemble, but then joined by David Fielder, who's in the main house at the moment playing Adam, Denise Goff, Marjorie Yates, who was Sir Toby Belch. So I had this lovely opportunity to let the directors I've been working with see me do a show. And sort of off the back of that, when we were in New York, Michael offered me to do Titus Andronicus, and here we are. So it's sort of, and then the week after that, Rupert offered me to do, asked me to do Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe with him. So within the space of about a week, I'd been offered my 2 sort of fairly big gigs.
And Michael and Rupert have obviously had a big influence on you, but they're to me seem very different directors. So what do you? What have you taken from them to kind of put in your pockets to influence your work?
Well, it's really difficult to take... directors shouldn't ever take too much aesthetic influence from other directors because then you'll just start copying mirrors of their work that you don't even realise about. And obviously, aesthetically, Michael and Rupert are very different. You probably say that Rupert is very bombastic and ideas-driven and intellectually very present in his productions and very visual. And you probably say that Michael is quite austere and quite pure in his productions. But one thing that does link them is actually there's lots of things that link them. One is actually they're all very, very loyal. And the second is that they absolutely adore actors. And that both of them actually really, really trust that if you just keep digging at the play with the actors you're in the room with, their imaginations will create something that is more interesting than something you planned before you started. So they were that central idea with those two very different people forms a lot of the way I approach the work. I feel like I need to go into rehearsals with not too much, so that then when I'm with the actors, I can generate something that is instinctively mine, but also formed by the people I'm working with. And then there's lots of things, you know, lots of things I'd learned. Michael's really good with human beings, basic. But Michael would be very good at knowing everybody's name and making everyone feel part of a family. And therefore can very brilliantly create a trust in the room and a relaxation in the rehearsal room that can bring brilliant things. And Michael has a sense of constant discovery as well. So Michael doesn't really care about being good. He just cares about being alive in the rehearsal room, really. So when I did As You Like It with Michael, I mean, we went back to rehearse that play four or five times, weeks on end, because we ran it for 3 years with Katie and John Joe and Forbes. And I remember we were in New York, and it was the third year of us running that play, and we were doing another week of rehearsals where Michael was changing every single scene. Because that constant sense of rediscovery is something that's really, really important to Michael. So during previews, I felt quite brave about completely changing stuff and knowing that it's never fixed. And then with Rupert, he's very different in some respects. He's very brave. He likes bold gestures. He likes to toy not just with naturalism but with expressionism and absurdism, and throw them all into the pot. He enjoys taking each scene he enjoys bringing out the tone of each scene rather than necessarily the tone of a production. So Rupert doesn't mind about when we first opened Romeo and Juliet in the courtyard. There was an opera. The moment when the parents discover what they think is the dead body of Juliet, we had a big opera. It was an opera, and we eventually cut it. You know, it was terrible. but the bravery to chuck something terrible at something, and in chucking something terrible at something, what's left maybe is nothing. What might be left is something vibrant and alive. Is also something I've took. And then what the result of that is me. and influenced by other people and all sorts of things. But they were big, strong presences and still are. You know, I talk to Michael regularly and I talk to Rupert regularly, and he'll send me the edit for his film and say, what do you think? They're good. They're good collaborators. What's brilliant about them, they've got a really strong instinct inside themselves that they'll keep working on, that they'll keep pushing towards, that they'll trust, but they'll listen to everything that goes on around them. They might not look like they're listening, but they'll keep on going, and they welcome people telling them and disagreeing with them, but they've got a huge inner sense of belief that keeps them moving forward, so that what you get with both of them is something that isn't watered down. And I think that is really, really important, because you'll only find the truth if you carry on being true to your central instincts.
Cool. So, forgetting about them, moving on to you.
Oh, darling.
Titus. It's not a play that's performed very often. I looked it up. It first performed in Stratford ever in 1955. Never performed in Stratford before that.
Peterbrook.
Oh, is it quiz? And then the last one, actually being a visiting... So the last RSC full production, 2003.
Ninagawa.
The last one being Ninagawa in 2006. Seven productions, including this one. I looked at Midsummer Night's Dream being performed seven times in 14 years.
So how boring.
So why do you think it's a play that's rarely performed?
I think it's just the Victorians. They ruined it for us. They ruined life for us, the Victorians. They were so conservative and dreary. And God, can you imagine living in the Victorian era? This was the big... Titus Andronicus was the big hit of the day. You know, I mean, it was as popular, more popular than Hamlet, actually. Lasted longer in the repertory. We know that because the fly scene from Titus was added during King Lear. We know that. Mm. There are scenes added later on in the play's history. It was seen as a fantastic play. And actually, to be honest, it was a play that was viewed not as that gory, because Elizabethan life was quite gory. No one talks about King Lear as no one focuses on the taking out of Gloucester's eyes as the highlight of Lear, or the only reason to go and see Lear. You talk about this extraordinary play about the division of family and grief and madness. So the Elizabethans, the tag on Titus Andronicus for the Elizabethans wasn't the violence, as well as the use of violence. But it's an extraordinary imagination in the violence that then gives way to a certain type of grief, which would have, and it's the dealing with grief and how we deal with grief and how grief can send us towards a madness that would have fascinated the Elizabethans, in my opinion. And, of course, a little bit of Off of His Head. That was all very interesting to the Elizabethans. The Victorians wanted a more refined type of theatre. They just did. They didn't want to see. And Ravenscroft and other people, they re-edited the play to make it much more sympathetic, because it was the Victorians that started having this idea that you had to have someone that you cared about in the play. I don't think Shakespeare was always that bothered with that. I think he would often play characters with a mix of brutality and humanity. I think to try and flatten them is not what he was interested in. And so the Victorians started to re-edit the play. I think, did Ira Aldridge do it as well? Ira Aldridge played Aaron, and the play ends and Aaron still lives. He becomes a hero. He becomes the hero of the play, and Titus becomes the villain. And the Victorians, because the play was brutal, banished it to theatrical hell for a long time. And then it was Peter Brook, actually, in the 50s, with Olivier and Vivien Leigh, that chose to revisit the play and say, actually, this is a play about monumental grief and suffering and how we deal with that as a human being and family and lots of things. And it was an incredibly successful production. So actually, if you talk about the seven productions that have been, I don't know if fate myself, but if you talk about the seven productions that have been at the RSC in the last 55 years, some of those have been absolute disasters because it is a tonally difficult play. But the Deborah Warner, the Ninigawa and the Brook have been three of the most memorable productions in the history of the company. So the play, when people are brave enough to do it, is actually it surprises people. Mm. It's a better play than people think. We're caught in a tradition of hating plays that the Victorians told us to hate. And actually, I think there's lots of Shakespeare's lesser-known works that are very, very, very rewarding, and that just history has let them down.
Were you interested in the play because it had been rarely performed? And does that give you a certain amount of freedom as a director? Because people aren't saying, oh, how is he going to do the whatever?
It gives you freedom. I suppose there's that aching moment if you're playing Hamlet where you feel the entire audience lean forward and go, how are you going to do To Be or Not to Be? It's a very different tension for watching. If you go and see a play at the Royal Court, or if you go and see a new play, you can sit forward and go, oh, God, what's happening here with this story? It's really, really hard to do that with Shakespeare. And the truth is, the best Shakespeare does that as well. But very, very often, what you're doing as an audience member is you're being asked to watch someone else's thesis on a story. How many Romeo and Juliets have we seen? And the enjoyment comes in, oh, what have they done with Romeo and Juliet? Mm. So what's brilliant with Titus Andronicus is most people don't know it, so that they can lean forward and go, what on earth is happening here? And a different type of electricity is let through. When it's cultural. When McKellen did Lear, they paired it with Seagull, and they fought really hard when they got to Singapore that Seagull would play. And the people in Singapore were worried about playing the Seagull, because to them it's not a known play. It's not a popular play to that audience. Sure enough, they played the Seagull in 2006, 2007, in front of an audience in the Far East, and they leaned forward and are shocked by it, like it was a first night. You know, so that did really, really excite me. And also, that excited me, but also I just read the play and thought, gosh, this is bonkers. and then the arrogance of youth thinking, this is probably impossible, so I'd quite like to do it. But I think that's a consistent thing.
Yeah.
Brook was young. Deborah Warner was young. Shakespeare was young when he wrote it. I think you need a certain youthful idiocy in order to try and stage something so seemingly impossible.
Mm. So in terms of your route into the play and things that you've done, you've cut the play slightly, moved things around. So a little bit about that process before you hit the rehearsal.
Yeah, because it was in the rep for so long for Shakespeare, it's editorially quite interesting. There's lots of different anomalies when you study it. And the fly scene, the first folio, you have a very strange thing where the fly scene is then followed by the scene where Lavinia is chasing the boy and revealing her rape. So it's very rare. Shakespeare never puts two scenes together with the same characters so that they sort of leave the stage and come straight back on again. It's a very rare thing. And editorially, that straight away made me go, hang on a minute. Actually, this fly scene is a bonus track. This scene was never there, and it's just been pushed into the folio, and we now think that's the way Shakespeare intended the structure of the play to be. He didn't necessarily. And there's lots of other references and things that are dated much later. And also, because it was so popular, people messed with it. During different periods, people re-edited the play, shifted the play around. So last year, I spent 3 months in California. It was nice sun, but it was incredibly boring. And I sat down with the Peter Brooks edit, The Birthplace, amazing resource. Peter Brooks edit from 55 with Sir Lawrence to the stage and Miss Lee to the stage. Don't forget your stumps. Miss Lee to the stage. And then I looked at John Barton's edit, which was a sort of bit of a hairy production back in the day. I looked at the Deborah Warner, which is sort of fairly unedited. I borrowed Greg's from his South African production. So I had about six different edits in front of me, and the first folio and the quarto geek. And then basically created a Word document that highlighted in red anything that Peter Brook cut, highlighted in blue anything that... So essentially I've got a script that's about three times the size of the actual script that I can read and see what decisions other people made. So that took about 6 weeks, and then off the back of that, I then started making my own decisions. Because the play had been jumbled around so often by so many different people and by Shakespeare himself that I felt like I could take a tough editorial hand with it, but only if I sort of researched heavy. And ironically, once we hit rehearsal, I did quite a big edit, but then the only thing that's happened in rehearsals is that often I've gone back to adding lines back in that I'd cut. I've not cut any more lines, I've actually put more lines back in. Because the more I rehearse it, the more I realise actually that the play is brilliantly written. Bizarrely written, difficult, uncomfortable, but brilliantly written. So I've gradually started returning more back.
So from doing that sort of cutting thing, are you in that moment, that's when that world starts...
Forming
in your mind?
No. Do you mean this world?
Yeah.
This business? I don't know, really. Like, obviously reading the play endlessly. Like, Patrick Stewart says he'll walk every day and read the play 70... Just keep reading the play aloud to himself 72 times or whatever. And that does have a via osmosis effect on you. I suppose a bit. It probably did help me form this world. I started to go, as I was working through it, I go, well, look, what's the structure of the play? What's the important things in the play? What are the oppositions in the play? How tonally difficult is the play? How often does the play feel like it moves to lots of different spaces, but it's actually all contained in one space? It's a really tricky one. It is a real tricky one to stage. And then I started doing what modern directors are often pressured to do so that you can get a job, which is say where you're going to set it. And it can be quite disheartening, especially when you're doing a Shakespeare, that the first thing you get asked is, where are you going to set it? And that's a very ready question to ask a director, and it's for two reasons. One is so that you can market it, because if you say, I'm setting it in... space, that's easy to do the poster. And also, if you say, I'm setting it in space, the person who's giving you the job can get a good handle on what they're going to get for their money. Mm. So there's two things. But that can be really, I think, really, really reductive sometimes, because sometimes what happens is, and it wasn't always the way, you know, Shakespeare's weren't always set in car keys with mobile phones. In illuminating a bit of the play, you reduce another bit of the play. And I sometimes find that a bit boring and annoying. And the Peacham... And while I was doing the edit, I discovered the Peacham drawing. So Titus is a fusion play anyway. Shakespeare isn't writing about Rome exclusively. He's using the prism of Rome to write about Elizabethan England. There's the word king and the word emperor in the same sentence. So straight away, there's a duality of a world. He's also writing about the Greeks. He's written a metaphoric play about the history of violence in man, really, and analysing all those things. I thought, well, that's quite fascinating, really. He doesn't feel the need to reduce the play to one specific place. He uses all these different places as a vehicle to discuss something more essential. So the Peacham drawing is one of the few remaining bits of evidence that we think, where anyone thinks, how Shakespeare performed the plays, and it's a production of Titus Andronicus. It's a drawing of Titus Andronicus performed at the Globe. And in that drawing, you've got people in togas with Elizabethan dress. So straight away, he's saying, well, we're sort of here, but we're also sort of here. So I gradually, as we worked, I started to realise that any context I tried to put on this play, other than Japan, actually, Japan feels like a good fit, made it smaller. And so I quickly realised that what we needed to create needed to be evocative of things, evocative of Mosley's fascism and Mussolini's fascism in very different ways, evocative of medieval England, evocative of Catholicism, but also evocative of the Arabic world. So that we are allowed to see the subconscious shadows of the play. So pretentious to say, but it's just true. Because I think if I set this play in Afghanistan, I'd be making a very clear statement for you to read. Lovely. And we can go, oh, this play's about that. That's why these people are so violent, because they're from Afghanistan. I get that. That makes the play more containable in my head. But I think the more interesting thing, I think what Shakespeare's trying to do is go, let your imagination make your own parallels. There's that power. I think, to be honest, Peter Brook's very good at that. Very good at making a kind of creating a hinterland that allows space.
Because there is that mixture of things. I saw it on Monday, and it's you come in and you feel that it's modern, and yet there's an age to it. There are rituals within the play that you kind of recognise, but you're not. But they're shifted slightly. So it's a recognisable civilization. But it feels like a situation that is in a moment of change. About to
break. Yeah, because the play starts, and it's so hard, because plays start and you have to bring history. Do you know what I mean? It's really, really hard to bring before. But in Titus, the simple thing is, it's a man that comes from an old world, a solid world that was built on ideas of piety and justice, that is in this moment about to fall apart. But he doesn't know that yet. So you sort of have to feel like he's returning back to the sacred place that he believed. Piety is really important, really, for the play and for Romans, and that the order of events, the order of structure, the order of beliefs, you know, the worth in Rome and worth for Titus at the beginning of the play, it goes God, state and family, in that order, with God at the top, state and then family. So at the beginning, you really have to set up a sense of a world that is really solidly clinging to God and state, in that order, that your monarch is in connection with God, and that your monarch is your earthly God, and that then your family are sacrificable for those things. So the fact that Titus kills his son in the first scene is because, in the order of priorities, in old Rome, in this old, ancient, ritualistic world, that's where your importance lies. And then what happens is, the more modern things come through, and he starts to realise during the play that actually God ain't listening, and political powers are fickle. And so actually he realises, God, it's all about family. I didn't even realise. Bum. I killed 21... I let 21 sons die in war for this pompous empire. And what it's got me is a savage daughter, my old confused brother, and a banished son. I've lost my hand. That's what you get for being a stoic... protector of old values.
It moves very quickly, doesn't it, in terms of those series of events kind of going down the wormhole for Titus, spilling him in a certain direction. And you've aided that feeling of a speed of change, a speed of things being able to, not just things, but people switching, turning on the sixpence, we keep saying that. But you've also, the first scene, and especially for people that we keep harping back to the Nina Gow, but it's the one that most of us have seen. It's normally the great triumphal entrance back into Rome. That's kind of the historical thing. It's what's, you know, in any stage directions, there's that sort of... And you've completely switched that, and we get a very filmic switch from place to place without it all taking... Can you explain a little bit?
Well, the first scene is set in one place. It's the tomb. But the tomb is also the place that they do all the big political speeches, and it's also the place where they come back into to argue about politics, but it's also the place he buries his kids, and it's also then becomes the Senate where they have an election, and also the place where they have a marriage. So it needs to be a lot of things at different times. And actually, when you look at the film version that Julie Taymor did, actually, that whole first scene lasts about one third of the entire play. When you do a film of Titus Andronicus, that first scene, in order to tell that story, because it's so complicated, is probably one third of your film. And actually in that, she does do it in loads of different locations, and you can see why, because you need to get a sense of these places being very real. So we've attempted to do a bit of that, really, to aid the idea of him returning home and with his boys, and then the movement into a sacred space where he buries those boys. And then when his brother comes in, how that space then suddenly turns into a senate. Not literally, but emotionally. So we just tried to make sure that every new entrance changes the world we're in and gradually destroys something. And then in regards to... We've got quite a reflective opening where Titus listens on the radio to the speeches about the election, which was a very new idea. The idea of free election to Elizabethan England was... What do you mean? We've got a divine monarch. Why have you written a play that's talking about free election? That's naughty. And but also, two people, Roger Allam and Tim Pigott Smith, we had lunch with them both, and both Roger and Tim said that they were in rehearsals for a production of Titus Andronicus that was badly reviewed. but the actor that played Titus was amazing. So he was amazing. And in rehearsals, they're going, this guy's fantastic. And why haven't the reviewers got why he's so extraordinary? And they said that two things. Doing big triumphant entrances with trumpets and tanks and chariots meant that Titus couldn't bring a story of a declining man that's too old. But also, literally, the production was too loud too early. Now, it's really hard, because basically you've got a whole end of the first half that is full of massive emotional gesture. And if you go there on the first beat... Nothing's left to unravel. You've spent your... I'm going to use a rude analogy there. You spent your load too early, basically. I did still do it, didn't I?
You did, yeah. Oh. But it's okay. We'll move quickly on and kind of use that metaphor in terms of the one of the heavy themes of this is fatherhood, succession, the passing on of...
Violence.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an addiction, isn't it? Because it's a human addiction. You know, we are all liberal. You know, just the fact we're here, we're all sort of liberal, free-thinking Guardian readers. But within that, not the Guardian reader, the Times, Telegraph, whatever. We read the papers. But we're also innately... there's a part of us that's animal and savage. It is. That will be awoken in... That can be awoken in some instance, you know. I've recently become an uncle and... I wouldn't call myself violent, but probably if someone tried to hurt that child, I'd probably, you know, put them in a pie. I could imagine it. You know, I probably would. So we are all innately violent, vengeful beings, and history has proven that politically we are violent and vengeful as well. And the problem is that's a continuum. That history has also proven that violence has only ever begot more violence. That's true. It's never really created peace, historically. It might have quietened down people for a little bit, but then their children grow up to revenge that. Do you know what I mean? That's the circle of life, and maybe that's just the way we are, that we kill to create peace, which creates resentment, which later creates more violence. And in Titus, there are killings that lead on to other killings. It's quite simple. And often what those killings are involving is the manipulation of the young. And Tamara manipulate two very young boys to rape and mutilate a young girl. They're right in the absolute centre of it. Titus teaches young Lucius, the son of Lucius, how to kill and revenge. Titus's sons are bred to go to war and kill people. So there's a kind of addictive continuum. And by the end of the play, really, that final speech, it's hardly Richmond from Richard, you know, it's hardly a hopeful ending, that speech from Lucius. The play ends and you're surrounded by massacre, and the world of the play doesn't really learn from that massacre. It says, okay, actually, you know, hang Tamora up by the tower and bury Aaron up to his neck in mud. And we have people are committing the same kind of torturous violences at the end of the play than they were at the beginning. Because the truth is, with Titus Andronicus, they don't learn. They don't learn. It's an infection that's spread through generations. And that's why the young are so important to it. So my cast, they're like, I've got really young cast. Mm. I've got my Demetrius and my Chiron are like 19 and 20. They were the original Michael Bankses and Mary Poppins. But then up from that, my Lavinia's 22. You know, it's a really young set of leads, leading right the way up to Richard Durden, who plays Marcus, who's, I won't mention his age. There's a real breadth of age within the company, I think, is important, because in some respects it's about how the old destroy the new. It's the same as in Romeo and Juliet. Those kids, what happens to those kids, in my opinion, is because of an adult world that is obsessed with violence, and therefore their ends are inevitably, because they live in such a violent world, going to be violent. Mm. They're quite bleak plays. Romeo and Juliet is not that romantic to me. I find it desperately unhappy.
How do you, in terms of this play being well known for its goriness, that people are going, how much blood are we going to get? You've got a very definite, or you've taken a very definite stepping of the violence through this, because it does happen very quickly when it starts, and then it continues. But it leads up to that final bloodbath, doesn't it?
Yeah, I have absolutely no interest in people leaving the theatre because they're going to faint. How boring. Because, you know, like now, if I said something incredibly salacious and cut my own throat, I could probably, as a cheap trick, make you all be sick. It wouldn't be that difficult to make someone be sick. And then I'd try and carry on and speak after that, but you wouldn't be listening because you'd be leaving. So what have I done to the viewing moment? I've just created a shock event. It's like letting off a firework and then trying to speak afterwards. The play can't exist in that context. I think there's more value in the play than that. So I always knew I wanted to create a gradual significance of violence. So that it meant something, these deaths meant something. B, that we had somewhere to go. And C, that we were able to still receive the play. So blood is used quite sparingly, and maybe people will come hoping for more guts, but that's fair enough. But I think if I bathe this stage in blood in the first moment, our attention would go somewhere else. And I think our ability to affect and shock people would become diminished. So I've just tried to plot it through in a way that, you know, when Titus cuts off his hand, I want people to believe that he's cut off his hand. But I don't want the fact that he's cut off his hand to detach people from the amazing things he says straight afterwards. Because I don't think Shakespeare wanted to do that. He'd have written a pause. You know, there's no pause written after Aaron cuts his hand off. And if Shakespeare wanted people to be sick at that point, he'd write a pause. He wouldn't write a fantastic speech. He just wouldn't. So I'm not interested in the gore. I'm interested in the violence.
And interestingly, one of the most, it's shocking, but it is the moment when the mother eats her
sons.
And there's no gore within that. It's just we as an audience are complicit in we know what's in the pie before everybody else does. So you get that murmur.
We do a bit weird as well. I said to Katie, because the boys I've cast look a little bit of the age of her actual child. And I said, how fun are rehearsals? I said, Katie, you know, what would you do in real life? What would you actually do? So I was thinking about this last night. If someone told me they'd killed my sons and put them in a pie, the first thing I'd probably do is grab the pie and eat it for myself. I said, you what? And she said, because I wouldn't want anyone else to do anything to those bodies. So probably the first thing I'd do would be to grab it and say it's all mine. So it's a bizarre moment in this when Katie says, when they say to Tamara, there's your sons. The first thing Tamara does is goes, bizarre.
It's put me off a pasty for a while.
That's put you off a pasty. The idea of that is more disturbing than...
Yeah. Can we very quick, before we open up for questions, in terms of Titus's madness, Because it seems to me that as soon as he arrives in this production, he is a man who's on the edge. He's tired, he's, you know, seen what he's seen.
Damaged.
You have him, you know, very visually with his dead sons. And he switches, and there are moments in the play where you think he has completely lost it, and then Shakespeare puts in an aside going, they think I'm mad. There's a beautiful moment when revenge turns up. Which is a bonkers moment if you haven't seen it. The mother and her two sons kind of playing these roles very badly and thinking they've completely got him. Could you tell us a little bit about the madness within that?
Well, I suppose I think Shakespeare, I just think he's brilliant. And I don't think he wrote... I think he understood madness was a scale, not a state. And I think the playing of stage madness is an incredibly reductive and simplified idea. You know, we have, you know, in all of our spheres, we've experienced intense moments that push us to a heightened state, at least, which some may call madness. You know, my mother, when I forget to call, you know, after a few months, will hit a state of high madness in regards to that idea. It's a scale. Mm. I've always found it's like Ophelia. You know, if you think that Ophelia is talking rubbish, you don't understand Ophelia. Ophelia is within a very heightened, troubled state, sending very clear messages to the people around her. And so is Titus. Now the heightened state pushes him into very metaphoric imagery that might be hard for other people to understand. But there's no moment in this play where Titus isn't talking about something very present. So we just try to approach it as truthfully as you can, which is Titus can't worry about madness. He just needs to play the intensity of confusion. And then from that, the audience can read madness, or is he mad or is he not? That's the tension. You know, Lear's madness is a scale, and you can move in and out of the mist, you know, quite nimbly. I remember my grandmother had... both my nan and my grandmother had four different forms of dementia, which isn't what Titus has, but about it being a scale. And at moments, she would be confused, talking about something she definitely understood. And then but we didn't. And then other moments, she would find absolute clarity and sense. I think that's the key. That's the key to Lear. That's the key to Ophelia. That you see madness as a scale of the human spectrum rather than a sort of wacky set of behaviours. Especially with Titus Andronicus, because if you just think he's mad the whole way through, and that's where we are, and he's unambiguously a loon, dribbling, and there's nothing left to watch. It's actually his descent into a bizarre state, and then his movement out of it. I think by the end, actually. There's a between the madness of the second half, there's a literary objective that he locks onto. He finds out that his daughter was raped and mutilated, as was Philomel in Ovid's Metamorphosis. And in that moment of high grief, he says, "But what's our lesson then, boy?" While looking at Ovid's Metamorphosis. What must we learn from this? He doesn't choose to share that with anyone else, and then sets about in this bizarre set of double bluffs and patterns in order to fool Saturninus and Tamora to end up at his house for a party. He does it in a bizarre fashion, but in a way the bizarreness of it makes them dismiss him. And in making them dismiss him, he's able to fool them that it's safe enough to come to his house. So you go, it's quite a good plan, really. And then at that house, he enacts a murder that is in direct symmetry with Ovid's Metamorphosis, the eating of two boys in a pie. So actually, there's an incredible sanity in feigning madness, because it makes people underestimate you, it makes the audience underestimate you, so that you can turn around and go, I've completed the story. You started using Ovid in what you did to my daughter, and I'll finish it with Ovid in what I did to your sons. And that's what my revenge is. It's imaginative, but it's quite cogent. There's a lot of sense in it.
Cool. If you haven't seen the show, I hope you enjoy it. I think that might be a wrong word to use. And if you have seen the show, I hope this has enlightened what you thought about it. Thank you very much for coming. And thank you, Michael.